Good morning. So, last time we did our kind of introduction, going over kind of broad themes we're going to have in this course. And we also, you know, maybe very relevantly for our first homework, did some little review, hopefully review, maybe not review, hopefully review of pointers in C, talking about some sort of both common points of confusion and some common patterns. And we spent some particular emphasis on the issue of confusing the scenario. I guess I should probably use a variable other than P to indicate it might not be a pointer. Confusing when we're assigning a pointer to a value versus the thing a pointer pointers to a value, which is one of the things I see happen a lot, causing students' code not to work the way they expect it to. And I mentioned that, well, there's compiler warnings for this, which you can turn into errors if you want. And you should really pay attention to them. And also mentioning the pattern that, well, because C doesn't really have a way of, say, returning multiple values, like this is not a syntax in C. Commonly, you'll see that when some library function wants to achieve that kind of returning multiple values idea, it will take in a pointer to one of what in another language would probably be a second return value. And we'll see this a bunch of times just incidentally this semester because we'll use some library function and they'll want to return something, that's how we'll use it. So questions about things we covered last time? Any logistics or? So, our main topic for today is going to be about building pointers. We previewed this at the end of last lecture. And here I kind of have a diagram showing the process of making a normal executable. And what you probably consider a normal executable is what's called dynamically linked. We'll talk a little bit about today. And my executable here, I have a main.c and a main.h. So I have a source file and a corresponding header file, and I also have an extra. So apparently main probably has the main function, but maybe I name my files horribly. An extra probably has extra functions, but maybe I name my files horribly. And presumably the .h files have the prototypes for those functions and other declarations we might need. And when I compile main.c, my compiler is going to read main.c, and main.c is going to say to include main.h and to include extra.h and to include, in this case, standard.io.h. And therefore, the compiler is actually going to read all of those files and use them to construct what we call an object file, which contains the actual code for this functions in main, and because we read the .h files, potentially some of the code for the things in the .h file. And you learned in CS01 that, well, there's actually an extra step we can have here, which is we can produce an assembly file, and that assembly file is kind of readable, and then gets turned into this object file. So that assembly file is produced from all of these files, and I have in blue standard.io.h because that's not a file we supply, that's a file the compiler author supplied. So I'm putting all the OS supplied files with this blue background. And extra.c will work the same kind of way. It includes some header files, so the compiler will read those when producing our assembly file. And that assembly file gets turned into this more efficient form of a .o file, which has the machine code instead of, text-based assembly. And then there there's this final step called linking, where we actually combine those .o files and some other files that the compiler provides into our executable. So we have this combining executable, and you would think, okay, we're including these system files, so the executable just has everything, right? We included our headers for the standard library stuff, and we included these system files, so we have all the stuff, but that's not typically how it works. Typically, there's some stuff that you need to run the program that isn't actually in the program executable file. And on Linux, our program will therefore typically, when we start it, it will load an extra file of libc.so, which contains the implementation of things like printf. Printf, xset, and some other functions we might be using. So that's not actually included in our executable file. Okay, so questions about this process? Yeah?
What types of system files are being combined
if my printf and so on implementation aren't in it? The most notable one is that when you run your executable, main is not the first thing to run. So there's some code which calls main. That's the most notable. So CRT something, which is the code that calls main, is there. Because typically on most OSs, main is not actually the first function to run. When you run an executable, there's some library code that runs first. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So what question, what are the .h files? So conventionally, when we want to use a function, so if extra.c has a function int foo, we'll have the implementation in extra.c, and we'll have in extra.h, we'll have a declaration of that function, which we need to know for the compiler to know, for example, that it returns an int and not like a double. And then when we use it, we'll include extra.h, and then we'll have some code that calls foo and uses that result. So the .h files contain these declarations. And the way pound include works, it is just text substitution. So if I didn't want to use .h files, which I don't recommend, but if I didn't want to do that, instead of having this .h file and including it, I could just manually declare foo. And this also means that, hypothetically, I could have a .h file that instead of just containing foo, a declaration of something, it could like actually define something. So it could define a function bar, in which case it would be as if I typed that declaration where I included it. I don't recommend doing that, but you will see some real libraries doing that. It's the main reason I'm mentioning it's possible. And also, just to point out, include is really text substitution. So everything in your .h file really does end up in the .o file. It's just usually .h files don't contain anything that turns into like assembly instructions. But not always. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
The actual code of the functions will end up at the bottom of the .c files? Or will the actual code end up in the .h files?
Questions, where does the code of the function end up? So if we have a case like my example of foo, where if I do the normal thing, it's declared here, none of the code of foo is going to be in this, let's say this is our main.c. It's going to be in main.o. Because the compiler never, when it produced main.o, it never read extra.c. It can't possibly know what that is. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? And I guess I point out that because it doesn't have any of the code, this combining step needs to consolidate that, that issue that we have this main.o, which is missing all the code we need, that's an extra O, so we need to like match them together. And that's the main thing what we call the linker is doing. So I said that this was step dynamic linking. And dynamic linking has this idea that when we run the program, it actually loads kind of some of our functions from another file. And typically these are functions that lots of programs use, like printf and so on. There's also another way we can build programs with static linking. If you use GCC or Clang, this is what the static argument turns on. And in this mode, the program contains our libc itself, so this has all our printf, xset, etc. And the program actually is self-contained. It has all the code we need to run it. This is not the default mode because it's a lot bigger. It's slower to make this executable, so usually that's not what we want. It also has the disadvantage that, let's say there's a bug in printf and I fix it. In this mode, I have to relink every single program. In the dynamic linking mode, well, the program, I just restart the program and it has the updated printf. There's also the disadvantage of that. It's, let's say I update printf to introduce a bug. In this mode, that old programs are unaffected. In the other mode, old programs suddenly don't work anymore. So questions on static linking? Okay. So that's our process here. We'll talk about some extensions. So mostly in this class, I'm going to be showing extensions for Linux, and I'm also going to be doing a thing where on Linux, typically executables have no extension. Sometimes for clarity, I will write .exe just so you know that it's meant to be an executable, even though on Linux, typically we would just not put an extension on an executable program. So we have our C source files are .c, our C header files are .h, our assembly files are usually .s. If you're on some other systems, like Windows, we'll more commonly call them .asm files. .o files is object files. On something like Windows, you'll more commonly see these called .obj's. And we also have libraries for static and dynamic linking. So something I glossed over is that this is libc.a, so our static library. And this is libc.so, so standing for shared object, for our dynamically linked library, for a library that's loaded at runtime. And .a and .so are the extensions on Linux. On Windows, you'll typically see .lib and .dll. On OS X, you'll typically see probably .a and .dylib. But there's also a few other bonus ones on OS X. So the exact names differ, but we have these two types of libraries, these statically linked ones and these dynamically linked ones. And they're typically formatted differently because we want loading a dynamically linked library to be something we can easily do as the program starts quickly. And for a statically linked library, we're less concerned about that and probably more concerned about like eliminating parts of the library that aren't relevant in the executable and things like that. And on Linux, the statically linked library I list as a collection of .o files, and it is more literally that than you would think. It is literally an archive, kind of like a zip file, but it's an older format But literally an archive of files, that's just an archive of .o files with a little index to help the compiler use it better. And .so files are kind of more like an executable in that we've done some work to combine things together into one clump of assembly of machine code, basically, that can be loaded all at once. And we, of course, have to have the information on the side to say, where is printf in this .so file? Where is xset? Because we need that in order to have our program that loads the .so file call functions inside it. And so let's talk about creating these different types of libraries next. But before I do that, so questions on these types of files, before we get into creating them. So let's talk about creating static libraries. So on most Unix systems, these .a files are static libraries. And we're going to have this naming convention for libraries, where the library foo is going to be called libfoo.something. For a static version, .a. The lib is literally a prefix there that we will add if it's the foo library. So like with libc, we call it, it's the C library, but the file is called libc, not c.a, for example. And this is a convention the compiler really follows. So you see here that my actual command to create an executable using this library, I'm going to write minus L for library foo, even though the library file is called libfoo.a. Like, I don't write the lib part. And if I just called it foo.a, I would need to use something different to tell the compiler about this library. So we expect the libraries to have this naming. And we create them with the AR command, which is the archive command. It's called archive because at the time there weren't multiple archive formats, so they could just call it archive. But this command actually originates that in early Unix, like in the 70s, 80s, this was the standard archive utility. And a typical command to create it would use AR RCS. This says to create an index. That's not creating it. This is, S is for index, C is for create, and R is for update if it's already created. You can look up in the man page what all the options do. Yeah, this is not a reference for the AR command. This is to tell you about it and give you the typical usage. And once you do that, you have libfoo.a, and you need to tell the compiler about it. So when you're producing your program, you'll typically provide information about where to look for libraries. So that's just capital L option. So that says there are libraries in the directory path to lib. If you put the library in one of the default locations, you don't need that. But the default locations are generally things the system administrator can install things in. So, on portal, you'll need it. You can't put things there. And then you put the library name after a dash lowercase l, and the compiler will look for it in all the standard locations and the extra locations you specify. It will look for libfoo.a. And it will add whichever ones it finds first to the executable when it produces the executable. And it's going to look at that library and make sure that any functions you use that are in that library are included in the executable. Because the way the compiler does this is that, this says look for libfoo.a and include needed code, needed parts. That's kind of what that lfoo does. And that I have it at the end because that indicates, that after you look at all the other files, now look at this library and include anything that seems to be needed. So if you don't do this, sometimes it will say, oh, there's this function printf, but I didn't see anything using it. Let's not put it in the executable. But if you put it at the end, it will have seen printf in the prior files, and that will work consistently. So questions on our commands for static libraries? Yeah?
So just to clarify, what exactly would be the standard location that removes the need for the...
Question, what would the standard location be? So on Linux, this is typically locations like user slash user lib, slash user local lib. On OS X, it's a completely different set of locations, or maybe not completely different, but different set of locations. And on Linux, it's actually, there's like a file that you can change what the standard locations are in slash etc. And that's why it's kind of vague about it. And because there's that file, like different like Linux distributions even have different standard locations. But there's locations which are standard in the sense of that the system is set up to always look there. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, other questions? Yeah? Why would you make a library instead of just compiling the dos together? So in the case of static libraries, it's basically a convenience thing. That like if I make something to handle PDFs, probably people want it as like a couple files and not all the .o files and all the .h files and all the, you know. Does that answer your question? Okay, yeah.
When should you use Clang versus GCC?
I'm not going to tell you which one. If you're on OS X, GCC is secretly Clang, which I always find very annoying, that's just silently how that works. On other machines, they are, you know, they are pretty feature equivalent, but they are actually like completely different code bases. And so they will occasionally do things differently. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
What is the third word? It says update, create, and what's the third word?
Index. So the AR files have an index for the compiler to find where certain functions are, basically. Where they're supposed to. Other questions? Okay, so that's static libraries. And shared libraries have some additional steps that we're going to need to worry about. But from a high level, the reason why we specified directories to look in and just the sort of stem, the base part of the library name, is that we'll name a shared library libfoo.so instead of .a, and we'll use the exact same command line options, and the compiler, you know, we'll decide whether to look for .so or .a based on if you're compiling statically, and you know, if there's no .so, we'll use a .a. As for creating .so files and libraries, that is more like creating an executable. Basically, you're creating an executable that's incomplete, but it's going to combine everything into one big binary file like your executables are. But there's some differences in how you compile. Probably the most notable one is you need to compile all the .o files that go in a dynamic library differently. And you need to compile them with this PIC flag for position independent code. So what's going on there is sometimes when the compiler writes assembly, it writes assembly that expects to be at a particular memory location. As we'll learn, even when we have multiple programs running at the same time because of address translation, they can appear to have a particular memory location, and many programs are written with memory locations hard-coded for that reason. This doesn't work for dynamically linked libraries because we want to load them in different programs, and we can't always load them at the same place. So you'll typically need to compile those as position independent code, and there's this compiler flag to say, don't generate assembly with any hard-coded addresses. And then once you're done, you do what you would do to produce an executable, but you provide this shared flag to your compiler, whether it's GCC or Clang, and you say the output file is a .so file instead of a, you know, executable name.
And then once you have this library, you put it in some directory, and you add that directory to the place to look for libraries, and you tell the compiler to use it to find it. Some questions? Yes, yes.
The dot, 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 that's all your
.o files. The .o files and any other options you want to provide to the linker, yeah. Other libraries, you know, debugging flags, things like that. Yes. Other questions? Okay. So this seems makes the shared library seem just a little harder, but you know, not too bad. Unfortunately, if you do this just here, you'll probably be disappointed. And the issue is that the -l, I said, says where to look for libraries. It says where to look for libraries when we're making the executable. But remember, dynamic libraries load something when the program runs. And when the program runs, it has a completely different set of places it looks, which is not controlled by the dash capital L flag, even though you might reasonably say it should have been, but that's not what the designers of this system 30 years ago decided to do. So this means that if I have my SO file and my source file, and I, you know, try to compile it together, if I don't provide a library search path, that's not going to work. But if I do, you know, it does work, right? I say, look in the current directory, that's what dash capital L dot is, and link with the example library. But then if I run that, the code that's loading that library will say, oh, couldn't find it, sorry. And the problem is that it's only looking in the standard system locations, the ones configured by the system administrator for the library. So there are two ways we have of changing that. But there are things we have to do in addition to specifying that dash capital L flag. So one is that we can set what's called an environment variable. So this is something we have to set each time you run the program to indicate some extra locations to look for libraries. So this, on Linux, this environment variable is called ldLibraryPath, and it says, in this case, dot is an additional location I want you to check for libraries you're loading at runtime. And if we set that, either we can set it each time we run the command, or we can set it in our shell, and then every command we run will have that setting. And it will be able to find example.so then, because it will look in the current directory for it, in addition to the other places it's looking for it and not finding it. Another option is we can pass a flag to when we're producing the executable to say, embed in this executable an additional place to look for libraries, which Linux calls the rpath, or sometimes runtime path. But that's set separately from the list of locations to look when making the executable. Kind of the logic here is that, you know, if we think of traditional commercial software distribution, often our environment for building the program is different than the environment we expect to run it in. And for that reason, they have these kind of two different options decoupled. Some questions? Searching libraries. Yes?
I'm sorry, what does the capital L dot flag do? Does the dot tell it that you're going to give it another address for the library?
This says, look for libraries in the directory called dot, in addition to other places. And the thing that confuses people here is that that tells the linker, the thing that's making your executable, where to look. It doesn't tell anything else where to look. Does that answer your question? Other questions?
run it with the dash WL flag that's on the property of the executable, no matter where you run it.
Question, when I run it with this dash WL rpath, does that become a property of executable? Yes. So if you run the correct object dump command, you can in fact see that dot in the headers of the executable. It is actually like embedded in the executable as a string. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's on finding shared libraries. I mentioned earlier the issue of order, just reminding that. And part of the reason why this, I'm mentioning this more so explicitly, is that this is a case where our idea that static libraries and shared libraries work the same doesn't work out. Right? We see that the compiler authors, you know, kind of tried to make, you know, this syntax is the same for both our static and our shared libraries, our dynamically linked libraries and our static ones. And, well, there were two ways it's not. And for dynamic libraries, the way it's not is that, well, there's this extra step of finding the library at runtime. And for static libraries, there's this issue that parts of the library we need might not be included if it's in the wrong place in the command line. With shared libraries, this usually isn't an issue because, well, we aren't actually checking the library until later. Can be an issue. Okay, so that's on building libraries. So questions about building libraries and using libraries and C. Yeah?
I'm still not sure on what the benefits are between like a static versus a shared library. Is it just like the ability to dynamically add files to the library anytime? Or?
So question, what's the benefit of a static versus a shared library? So why would you use a static library instead of a shared library is your question?
Or like why would you use one or the other?
Okay, so let's see if people have any ideas. People usually, there's a bunch of ones. Any reasons you prefer one or the other? Yeah.
So I guess maybe if you're using a dynamically linked library, if you updated the dependency, you wouldn't have to recompile the original program?
Yeah, so dynamically linked libraries have the advantage that if you update the library, if you fix a bug in it, you don't have to recompile it. For libc, this maybe doesn't seem so important, but if we think of like a complicated library, like a library giving us like a browser view, like there's probably lots of things we might expect to update, and it'd be annoying to relink all the programs that use that. On the other side of that, sometimes that's a reason not to use dynamic libraries. So many people who are like distributing software that's paid for might want to be very sure that all their customers are using the right version of the library. And, you know, as in the version they tested with, and not some other version on their system. And the easiest way of doing that, not the only way, but an easy way of doing that is just to statically link everything. You don't have to worry about versions being not what you originally shipped. And other reasons to choose dynamic versus static? Yeah.
The executable would be smaller if you use a dynamic.
So executable size, yeah. And you have a different one or same one? Okay. Yeah, so the executable size. So the dynamically linked libraries are much smaller. So if we think of like my system here, I probably have like several hundred executable files, maybe even several thousand executable files that all use like printf, fgets, and you know, things like that from the C library. If they were all statically linked, I would have 1,000 copies of those functions. But because it's dynamically linked, I only have about one or two. Is that okay? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions about? Okay. So now that we know how libraries are made, we're going to talk about automating building programs. And this is going to include, you know, a general way of doing that's going to handle libraries and other situations. We're mostly going to start with situation we started out with, building a normal program. So I have my program that has main.c and extra.c, and we say both of these use extra.h and standard.io.h. And here is how I normally build the program. I normally run this clang minus c, main.c. This produces main.o. I run a command clang minus c extra.c, which produces extra.o. And I run clang minus o program, main.o, extra.o to produce program from the 2.o files. So my first question here is, if I change main.c, which of these commands must I rerun? Obviously, I could just rerun all of them, but I'd like to save some work if I can. So what commands do I have to rerun? And the same thing for b, and I'll give you a minute or two to check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what the answer is, and we'll do a show of hands. Some more time? Okay, so let's start with question A. Who thinks we need to rerun command 1? Thinks we don't need to rerun command 1? Okay, so we have definite agreement on 1. Who thinks we need to rerun command 2? Thinks we don't need to rerun command 2? Okay, and not 2. And who thinks we need to rerun command 3? Thinks we do not need to rerun command 3. Couple people. So we have a plurality saying 1 and 3, and this is what I get. So and a way I can think of this is I go back to my diagram here, and I think, oh, main.c, it changes main.o, and changing main.o changes the program. So I need to rerun the commands that make main.o and the commands that make the program. And how about B? Who thinks we need to rerun command 1? Okay. Who thinks we do not need to rerun command 1? A few, so we're a little less sure on 1, but a plurality probably yes. Who thinks we need to rerun command 2? Thinks we do not need to rerun command 2? Okay, also a little less sure on that. And who thinks we need to rerun command 3? Thinks we do not need to rerun command 3. Okay, so most people saying 3. Okay. And I think the best answer here is we need to rerun all the commands. And this one's a lot less intuitive because of what's typically we would imagine the change for extra.h to be. Now, as for this out, we can go through the same logic we saw before and say extra.h is what's changed. And that's going to affect main.o, and that's going to affect extra.o.
Therefore, we need to run the commands to reproduce each of those to reflect anything that might have changed. And then we need to update the program because those changed. Now, many people would have the complaint that, like, well, sure, extraordinates changed, but surely that change isn't going to actually change anything in main.o. Right, how would that happen? And this is a reasonable guess to have, because it turns out, like, yeah, most changes we make to extraordinate wouldn't affect main.o. Like, if we add a new function to extraordinate and main never calls it, a new function prototype, and main never calls it, probably there's no actual change to main.o. The problem is that we're not guaranteed that. And I think there's two kind of realistic scenarios I can imagine. There are going to be three realistic scenarios I can imagine where we definitely need to reproduce main.o. And this to give it motivation. So one of these is that, let's say our change to extra.h is changing foo's return type. Then the assembly code that deals with getting the return value from foo needs to be completely different. So that will change the code in main that calls foo, if there is any. That's one example of a change where the .h file doesn't contain anything weird, but we in fact do need to recompile because the assembly code that uses those functions will change. And we can have a similar thing because with structure. So often we'll have structs declared in .h files. And so let's say I go from a struct that has int x and int y to a struct that has int y, then int x. Since these are now in different order in the struct, all the code that deals with the struct needs to change where it looks for x and y in the struct. And that's just a change to the .h file, but it's going to really change all the assembly code, and if we don't recompile, we're going to get the wrong values all the time. And another case is that, well, because the way include works is that it just copies the code from the .h file into the C file effectively, we could in fact have a kind of an actual function in the .h file. Extra.h could have a static, you know, int with an actual implementation that is in the .h file. Is this good style? Probably not, but it is perfectly legal, and you will see a non-trivial number of C libraries doing that, especially for functions that are relatively short. So I'd say for that reason, you know, in the worst case, we definitely need to recompile. And if you want to avoid doing it in the cases which are right, like if we just added a function to extra.h, I don't need to recompile everything. If you want to avoid doing that, we need to somehow track the extra information. And in practice, we usually won't do that. Even though conceptually, yeah, we could come up with a system to do that. In practice, we don't. And I think it's unlikely you'll see something doing that because it's a lot of complexity to track. And if you get it wrong, it's really bad. Like, really hard to debug. You miss a case. So probably people will just recompile just in case instead. So questions about our answers for these two exercises. Okay, so we're going to talk about a utility for building program called make, which is going to try to automate these decisions about what commands do we rerun and do that. And it's going to do that not by memorizing how C compilation works and having that hard-coded. It's going to do that based on rules in a configuration file called a makefile. And it's called a makefile that is literally the file name. So on Unix, it's expected to be makefile, or makefile with a capital M at the beginning. Literally that file name, literally with no extension.
the idea of having rules here is that even though I'm going to show you examples of doing this for C programs, you can use this to automate building kind of anything, including other languages, other compilers, because all make is going to do is it's going to run commands based on what files have changed. And this is also how kind of maybe more modern build utilities generally work. It's all the same kind of idea that they're looking at what files have changed and they're tracking which files depend on which other files and what commands or other things to run to produce them. So make, in the make file, has a bunch of rules, and here's an example of a make rule. And we have first a target, or it can be actually be a list of targets. In this case, the target is main.o. So that's a file name that we expect to be updated by the command we're specifying. Make isn't actually going to check if those correspond correctly. It's just going to assume that we run this command and it's going to produce this file. In this case, we run playing minus wul minus c main.c, and it produces main.o. After this colon, we have a list of prerequisites, sometimes also called dependencies. These are the things that this command is going to read to produce that file. And as we saw, the things where if they get changed, we want to rerun this command. Then we have a list of commands to run. And because make was maybe written before people thought much about how text editors work, make requires a literal tab character. I don't mean, and by tab character, I mean an actual ASCII tab, not 8 spaces, or any other number of spaces. So when you're doing the make lab, you might need to make sure you configure your text editor correctly to let you do this. Because make will complain and not work if you put 8 spaces there. I am representing the tabs with this arrow to make it clear that they're tabs, but obviously the way most of your text editors are configured will just appear as white space. But then there's this tab character and a list of commands to run. We can actually have multiple commands if we want. In this case, that doesn't make sense, but that's supported in a make rule if we have something more complicated to do. And make will look at these rules and say, if we ask make to build main.o, it's going to check, are any of the prerequisites newer than the current version of main.o? And if so, it will run the command, otherwise it will not. Now, I just showed you one make rule here, and what makes make useful is that we can have these chains of rules. Because make will first, before it runs this command, it will check, is main.c and main.h and extra.h up to date? Now that doesn't seem super useful here because, well, they're files that were edited in by hand. Of course, they're the most recent version. But where it is useful is that we can have chains of make rules for those generated files. So for making a program from .o files, we can have a rule for creating the program from the .o files and a rule for creating each of the .o files. And we can just ask make to produce the program and it will look at all the rules and figure out what order is an appropriate one to run things in based on this. And it will handle situations which are less intuitive, like if we have a bunch of libraries, it will build the libraries before executables that use them, if we set up these rules correctly. And it will only build things where the prerequisites say they aren't up to date right now. Questions? A chain of make rules. So this is what I'm going to put in a file called makefile, and then I will run a command with make to try to apply one of those rules. And sort of most explicitly, we can tell make build a particular target. So in this example, I could tell make run make program, and make will try to update the program file, but it won't just run all the commands. It will only run the ones that looks like need to happen based on modification times and so on. Or I could specify explicitly other specific files with rules. More commonly, if you see some software, they'll often tell you just to run make with no arguments, and that just looks for the first rule in the make file and its target, and it runs and it builds that. Yes? So question, when you make your make file, do you need to have the first rule be the one with the most dependencies? No, but you want your first rule to be the one you want to be the default. So, you know, if we're thinking of, like, this is my program, you know, that rule would be the default. That's usually what that would be. It might not be the rule with the most dependencies. So, like, if I have a program I'm distributing, maybe the first rule just builds the program, but maybe there's another rule which builds, like, a test for the program, and that probably has more dependencies because it builds the program and then builds tests. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the question is, what if I have a rule and where the target isn't updated by a command? So what if I make a mistake here, and this is extra.c, so that rule doesn't work. So what's going to happen is make is going to see that you updated main.c, and it's going to run this command like you told it. And main.co won't be updated, and make will keep going. And main.o won't be updated. You run make again, make will see, oh, main.o is still not updated. Let's run that command again. So it will keep trying to run that command. It's not going to detect that something's wrong. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
I'm not sure if I misunderstood how this is happening, but so the first thing that it'll run is it'll compile the program, right? Or if you just run just make?
If you run just make, it's as if you typed make first target, where first target's whatever the first rule in your make file is.
Yeah. So if you, do you mind going back to the slide?
Yeah.
So for this, it would then compile program using main.o and extra.o?
Yes. And the way that works is before we build run this command, we want to make sure main.o and extra.o are up to date.
Okay.
So we're going to run their commands first.
Okay.
So make is going to handle the whole potentially many step process to make sure everything's up to date in the right order, provided you write the rules correctly. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, and speaking of running things in the right order, here I have a little make file. What commands should make w run given these modification types? You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should go on here.
X more reason. 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 X more re
Like some more time? Okay, so who thinks our answer is A, not, no commands need to run? Okay, how about B, just build Y? C, build W and then build Y? D, build Y and then build W? E, build X, build Y, then W, okay. F, build X and then build W? And G, something else? Okay, so we have actual consensus, which usually doesn't happen when I ask this question. Okay, and so that's, I got, so the way to think about this is make W says build W. The first step the make file is gonna make is gonna do is it's gonna say, let's make sure everything it depends on is up to date. So before we look at when things are modified for W, we're going to make sure X and Y are up to date. So to make sure X is up to date, I need to make sure Q is up to date. And Q doesn't have any rules, so we're going to assume it is. And then I need to build X if it is less recent than Q, which it is. Then I need to make sure Y is up to date. And Y doesn't exist, so it's definitely not up to date. So that means I need to build Y. To build Y, I first need to make sure that Y's dependencies X and Z are up to date. We know X is up to date because we just built it. So we're going to check if Z is up to date. And it looks like it is because there's no rule for it. So we're going to build Y because it is, you know, less recent than either of those by not existing. And then we're going to build W, because now, after we do that, W is going to be less recent than our newly built X and Y. Yeah?
So I have two questions. One, just to clarify, if, like, since Q and Z, like, don't have any rules associated with
them,
we just assume that
they're fine? Correct, so Q and Z don't have any rules, we just assume they're fine? Yeah. Or alternately, you can think of them having an implicit rule with no prerequisites and no commands.
Okay. And then my you wouldn't have to do build X, you would have just done build Y, then build W.
Yeah, so question is, if Q was 4 hours old instead of 2, then yeah, we wouldn't, this dependency wouldn't be restricting, so we wouldn't have to build X again. Other questions? Yeah.
Would this then, like, if you had modified kind of several files and possibly in like the wrong order of the dependencies, like, would that then kind of like impact the way the make file runs?
Question: if I modified the files in the wrong order with the dependencies, would that impact how the make file runs? So, if your dependencies are correct, no, because remember something we did here is the make file realized I just updated it. And that triggered extra things to run.
Got it.
So as long as your dependencies are right, make will do things in the right order because it's going to like make sure things are up to date, and it's going to realize when I update something, well, now it's newer. So that's going to trigger a chain of things to run. Yeah. Back to the question, yeah. Yeah, so question, even though Q is newer than X, you still run the X command because Q is newer.
Okay.
So a way of thinking about this is that might be more intuitive is you could imagine that X is like main.o and Q is like main.c. If I just updated main.c, or updated main.c 2 hours ago, I better have a new main.o for it. So question for W is dependencies are much older than it. So one of its dependencies is much older than it. And the other doesn't exist. But kind of the way make will process things is that it's not going to like look right now at how old the dependencies are. Because before we check the age of the dependencies, we first check, make sure they're up to date. So we're not really actually, so it's kind of a red herring that you can compare when W and X and Y are modified right now, because we're not going to actually do that. We're going to first make sure X and Y are up to date, then we're going to compare them to W. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. Yeah.
So is there an example where you would not run build X and build Y, like if the timing was different, like if the,
So the question is, there an example where you not run build X and build Y? So for not running build X, you know, if we change when Q is updated, then it looks like X is recent, more recent than it, and doesn't need to be rerun. In the case of Y, well, as long as Y doesn't exist, we better run build Y. Analogy of this that might maybe make it more intuitive is that you could imagine Y is like a program, right? If the program doesn't exist, you better make it or else things aren't going to work. That answer your question?
That it would be related to timing of W because we start at the end.
Because Y doesn't exist, there's nothing we can change about the timing of W or about the modification times of anything else that will keep us from having to rebuild Y, given that W depends on it. That answer your question? Yeah. Yeah. Question, if you got rid of the Y and the rule for Y, would you still have to run a rule for X? Yes, because our first step in building W is make sure X is up to date. And we also always run build W because Y would always be, you know, out of date versus W. Yeah. Does make only look at when the file was last modified? It basically only looks at whether the file was last modified or whether it exists. And of course, it also tracks, you know, if it ran a command that should have made the file. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So when I'm talking about the default target for make, I mentioned that the first rule is the default. So often you'll have
some targets that are kind of meant for use on the command line. And often this will be one of the default targets. So if we have a something with multiple programs to build, we would probably like it to be the case that you can build all the programs at once without typing all of their names. So here I have a rule called all, which is not a file I actually want to create. It just exists to depend on the other things. Because when we run make all, it's going to say, make sure program one's up to date, make sure program two's up to date, make sure libfoo's up, .a is up to date. And then it's going to say, well, all isn't up to date, and we're going to run the commands to build all, which there is no commands. And so this achieves the effect of making all kind of an alias for all of these things to build. So this is an example where we're kind of making rules sort of as a command line shortcut. And this is a very common thing you'll see with make. And sometimes we'll have rules that are shortcuts for other things. So for example, it's very common to have a clean rule that removes generated files so I can have them be, you know, force recompilation even if make doesn't think things are out of date. You know, maybe I change my compiler options, and that means I need to recompile things, and I want to use those new compiler options even if the .o files are more recent than the C files. So you might have a rule for convenience to do that. And there's a little problem with this. So with all, we just don't expect there to be a file named all. And even if there is, actually, it doesn't cause an issue because, well, if I have a file called all, make all is make checks that, you know, program one are up to date. Then does, you know, so make will all update those files regardless, even if I have a file called all. So that's not actually a problem, though it's a little weird that make's going to be looking at the file called all in this process. But if we have a file called clean, this clean macro idea doesn't really work. Because make's going to say, oh, there's a file called clean already, I don't need to do anything. And it's not going to run that command because we already made the file called clean. Now that command doesn't actually create a file called clean. It's just so we can type make something and run a command conveniently. But because this is such a common pattern, as kind of a nit, we want a way of telling make that this is not a real file rule. This is just a convenience rule. And there's this pseudo target.phony for marking things as, please don't look for an all or clean file. These are just kind of commands I've implemented in make as kind of macros for me to run later. Questions about this phony idea? Yeah. So if you don't do that for all, like it doesn't cause any problems, except make is just going to check for an all file when it doesn't need to. For clean, if you create a file called clean, it breaks your clean rule. Yeah.
Clarify this phony. Is it just you define it in the make file?
You define it in the make file. Yeah, it looks like a rule, but it's really special. Anything starting with a dot and a capital probably is special in that way. Yeah.
So if you didn't make an all or clean file, you wouldn't need to do the phony.
So if you know there's never going to be a file called clean, then the phony doesn't matter. I would recommend doing it because you don't want to have things break in these cases. Yeah?
Why do you want to remove main.o and extra.o?
Why do I want to remove main.o and extra.o? So a common reason for this is either to save space, you know, if I don't care about those, you know, if I'm not developing this project actively, or if I want to, like, force a recompilation, like I changed how the C compilers run, or I upgraded my C compiler, I want to recompile everything. That would be a convenient way of forcing that to happen. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Good. And in main, there are conventionally some standard targets you'll see, you know, defined for common tasks that have this kind of make something to do a common task, like make clean to remove generated files, make test to run tests, that sort of thing. So one thing you may have seen with make is that things are already a little inconvenient and very redundant. So in this make file here, let's say I want to change to use different flags for my C compiler. I want to change from Clang to GCC. I have to edit a whole bunch of places to do that. And this is a small project. If I have something like, with like 50 files, that seems really annoying. But make has a bunch of ways of avoiding this redundancy. And the first thing I'll talk about is variables and macros. So you can define these what are called variables or macros, and I'm showing you the names that are conventionally used. So conventionally, the name of our C compiler is CC. The flags to the C compiler are C flags. The flags used when making an executable, when linking, are LD flags. And libs or LD libs is the libraries to include. And this allows me to have one place where I can change how my compilers run and so on, rather than retyping that in every single command. Some questions about these variables slash macros? Okay. The other thing is that there are some predefined special variables that refer to things in the current rule. And they have these weird names, which I don't expect you to memorize, and maybe weren't the best choice, but $@ is the target of the rule, so that's this part before the colon. $up bracket are all the dependencies of the rule, so that's this thing here. And $less than is the first dependency. So this avoids more redundancy. I just copy and paste the same thing and only write the file names involved here once. Questions about these, well, sometimes called implicit variables. Okay. And this is still a lot of redundancy though, so we're gonna do better than this. And I'm going to show you a way of doing better than this, and I have to make a little aside that what I'm showing you works on Linux, with Linux's make, which is by far the most common. There are some other versions of make that don't support this way of doing it, have some other way of doing this that I'm probably not going to go over. And this is pattern rules. That I can have a rule here where I say every .c file is built, so every .o file is built from a corresponding .c file, and I just write that pattern, and make will apply it anytime it needs to build a .o file, it will look for a .c file. And you might say, what about the .h files? Well, I can have separate rules here that get merged with that pattern rule, so I have all the dependencies included. So this way I can avoid a whole lot of more redundancy this way. Questions? Pattern rule, yes. This is saying if there's a target.o, look for a .c file, and if it looks there is one or a rule for one, then yeah, do that. Yeah.
So does this mean that every basically for you can have different rules for the same target and
you have different rules for the same target and would check all of them?
Because in this case?
Yes, you can do that. Yeah.
Okay.
That is possible. And you might say, well, this seems like a common pattern if I told you these are conventional. And in fact, there are built-in versions of that rule. That bill is hard-coded in make. You don't have to write it. So I can just set my C flags and CC and just rely on that rule existing. With the caveat that you cannot do this in the lab. In the lab, we want you to not use built-in rules, but they exist. Where basically, this exact rule is hard-coded in make. Yeah? Yes. Garrett, I mean, okay, so that's where we'll finish up.
Yes, question. Yeah, so in the make lab, we'll have you pass the command line option to make that disables built-in rules.